Are you a marketing or advertising professional looking to stay ahead of the game? Well, we've got the perfect opportunity for you. Advertising Week New York is back for its 19th edition, and it's bigger and better than ever. Picture this: 4 jam-packed days of inspiring keynotes, thought-provoking panels, and networking with the industry's brightest minds. Advertising Week New York is where the world's top brands, agencies, and leaders come together to shape the future of marketing and advertising. But wait, here's the best part. You can secure your spot at Advertising Week New York during the exclusive Early Bird Summer Sale. Act fast and save 30% on all pass types. That's right, you'll have access to every session, every workshop, and every unforgettable moment. Don't miss this chance to gain insights from the industry's trailblazers, connect with potential clients, and elevate your career. But remember, this sale ends on August 1st. Head over to advertisingweek.com/New York today and buy your pass. No promo code needed. The 30% discount applies automatically. Advertising Week New York, the ultimate gathering for marketing and advertising professionals. Be part of the conversation, be part of the innovation, and be part of the future. Get your early bird sale pass now and join us at Advertising Week New York. With the Women's World Cup creating further excitement around women's sports, the Rugby World Cup later in the year, and football continuing to grow in popularity, many advertisers are looking to capitalize on sports' major tentpole moments. In this session, from Advertising Week Europe 2023, our panel shares their own experiences and recommendations around how brands and content owners can successfully cut through with high-impact storytelling in sport to engage audiences at scale at a time when sports consumption is changing more than ever.
I'm Ruth Mortimer. I'm the Global President at Advertising Week. Now, if you know me, you know I have literally no skills in the world of sport. The only sport I'm any good at is endless talking, which is something actually shared by all the Advertising Week team. Now, luckily, I'm joined here today by a panel who not only have some sporting talent, I think it's fair to say, but incredible sporting knowledge. And because we're here at Advertising Week talking all week about creativity, we're going to be talking about the topic of storytelling in sport. Now, I'm going to introduce each of my panelists. So on my left here, I have Gabby Logan. She started her career as a sports person herself, so she definitely does have skills in sport. And now she is one of the UK's most loved sports broadcasters and TV personalities. Her work was recognised with an MBE for services to sports broadcasting and promoting women in sport. I'm going to keep going, Gabby, just to really embarrass you. She has presented everything, the Olympic Games, Commonwealth Games, World Cup coverage, and the Euros. She's written for everyone, from the Times to the Guardian, and she published a memoir, The First Half. You don't look old enough to have had the first half yet, Gabby. This is the good news. And she also hosts an incredibly successful podcast called The Midpoint. And I believe, Gabby, that your Euros coverage from last summer actually won a BAFTA earlier this week.
Did on Sunday, yes.
Amazing. So also award-winning in this very week. Okay, so that's a bit daunting. Next to her, we have Hugo Monnier. Hugo is a professional rugby star. He spent his playing career at Harlequins, where he won the Premiership and European Challenge Cup twice, which is twice more than I've ever won pretty much anything, Hugo. He played for England and he was selected to tour South Africa with the British and Irish Lions. But now he too is a television star, becoming a lead member of BBC Sports rugby coverage, a captain on BBC One's hit show A Question of Sport, and he even appeared on Strictly Come Dancing. How did you do, Hugo?
Oh, blinking, you'd have missed it.
Ah, well, luckily he has more important work that he does too. He is a champion for equality with the RFU and a trustee for the Women's Sport Trust and Restart. And at the end, we have Nikki Stanton. Nikki has more than 15 years experience, even though she too looks too young for this to be possible, at leading sports consultancy agency DSM, which is part of YMU Group. She specialises in helping brands and right holders activate their partnerships in sport. Her clients include working with Warner Brothers on Ted Lasso. I bet you have some interesting stories there. We'll talk about that later. And building campaigns for Xbox. Previously in charge of commercial partnerships at the FA, she really is an expert in sports storytelling, which is pretty good because that's exactly what we're here to discuss today. So, Gabby, you're sitting near me. I'm going to start with you. You've hosted so many big sporting moments, the World Cup, Olympics, Euros, Sports Personality of the Year. What are two or three of those biggest moments you look back on with kind of real pride to have been part of?
I think the journey of women's sport through my career almost, in terms of when I started out, what we saw in terms of women's sport and what we see now is something that I've been able to reflect on quite a lot in the last year because of some big moments. And one of those would have been the Women's Euros last summer when the Lionesses won, and 23 million people saw that on the iPlayer and BBC One, over 17 million on BBC One. And that journey from when I first started presenting women's football on the BBC back in 2007, where the resources we had at our disposal were minimal, the audience was low, the interest, you know, you're regularly on social media told nobody cares about this, why are you showing it, you know, to get to that stage, you know, in what feels like a short period of time, actually, you know, relatively to kind of where the sport came from. I would say last summer was definitely one of the moments where I felt enormously proud to be part of that team that was bringing that coverage, because we committed to it and the BBC has committed to it for a long time. And now, of course, a lot of other commercial broadcasters are really interested in it because it's a very attractive product. The people who are involved in the game, the women are incredible. Their stories are still so kind of brilliantly authentic and grassroots based. And, you know, they've got a fantastic way about them with the media, the way they still go out into the crowds and talk. And also who goes to watch women's football is really interesting. You know, the crowd is made up of families, dads with daughters, mums with their sons, teenage boys kind of just going on their own. And, you know, because it's still quite accessible. So I'd say the Women's Euros was a real kind of pinch yourself moment. And as you say, was, I think, brilliantly awarded a BAFTA on Sunday. And then we go back 10 years before that to the London Olympics in 2012, which for me was another kind of game changing moment, because again, it relates to women's sport. I've always been an Olympics nut. I was a gymnast. That is the absolute upper echelons of what you can achieve in your sport is the Olympics. And so I've always loved the Olympics because of its purity, which sounds slightly kind of at odds with some of the stories that emerge from, you know, drug taking and athletics and various other things. But it still, for me, is a very pure arena of sport, because anybody, any shape, any size, any colour, any creed, you know, you go into an Olympic village and you see every kind of human being, because there is a sport for everyone. And so I've always loved that about the Olympics and the stories behind the stories. But 2012 was the first time that women like Beth Tweddle, Jessica Ennis-Hill, Helen Glover, you know, they became household names from that Olympics. More women won golds than men in the British team. And it felt like women were actually kind of the story in those Olympic Games. So I'd say those two, at the risk of going on and on, because I know you've got lots of questions and you've got great panellists, those two for me stand out as moments that really did kind of, the temperature changed and also the coverage from 2012 onwards, because actually it all kind of, the DNA kind of all runs back, because 2012, the British football team, because they were called Great Britain, obviously, at the Olympics, played against Brazil and sold out Wembley. And that was a moment as well where people kind of went, this many people are coming to watch women's football. And on Sunday, we had a new global record of 77,000 people at Wembley watching a domestic football match. It beat the Spanish record of 60,000. So, you know, that journey has been amazing. I could throw in the last weekend at Twickenham as well, and the Six Nations this year, where nearly 50,000 came to watch that. But we might get onto that later. But I'd say those two.
Okay, we're definitely going to come back more specifically to women's sport, because I think you raise a really good point, and that really is the story of the moment. But to think about some of the storytelling with brands who are in this room, Hugo, you've created some really successful storytelling partnerships with brands, like you're travelling fan content with O2, you work with L'Oreal Men Expert, Gallagher. Tell us a little bit about how you've worked with them and how to create something that feels really engaging.
Well, with O2, it was a massive challenge, actually, because O2 have been the longest sponsor of the England rugby team, over 20 years. And at the World Cup, you can't have any sponsorship branding on it. So whilst they lose that visibility, in which way could they have prominence? And for me, I kind of think of two things. I want to work with good people doing things that I really enjoy. And In 2019, the Rugby World Cup was in Japan. I'd never been before, so it got me interested in it. I was on Google trying to understand the culture, the people, the way in which it might be consumed and how they were going to manage a Rugby World Cup. And then I thought of O2 and England Rugby. And I wanted to see if there are any parallels in terms of values and culture between O2, England Rugby and Japan. And at the helm of it was Eddie Jones, the England Rugby, former England Rugby coach. He's half Japanese. So it just kind of made sense. I started digging a little bit deeper. There was so much synergy in terms of the values. But I'm also really aware, especially with Gen Z, that they deeply care for things that actually matter, but also people that want to be preached at. So how could I combine values, synergy in values between Japan, England Rugby, but do it in a fun and palatable way? So I rang Jamie Lang, formerly of Made in Chelsea. He's a huge rugby nut, and despite injuries and lack of talent, he would have won us the World Cup himself. And he says it, he admits it. He's a rugby nut, but he also speaks to a far broader audience. And with these main eventers, you don't just get your rugby purist or your fan fanatic. You get a plethora of people who are just main eventers like me. Like, I love boxing, but I just like the main events. So we went out there and I scripted this thing, which effectively was a bucket list trip, but loads of fun. So we went to karaoke, went and met a modern day lady samurai. We played rugby with the locals, the grassroots, and we created this piece of content that was really fun, really engaging, and actually spoke to anyone and everyone. You didn't have to like rugby to like the content we produce. So that was a real nice challenge, and to have autonomy over that and then find partnerships that had a shared vision for us to be able to promote and produce something which I thought was really engaging at least. And you mentioned L'Oreal, fantastic once again. And men, there's a bit of a myth about us not wanting to take care of ourselves, and how could we once again get that message across with real good brand identity, but produce a decent bit of content which engaged and was quite lighthearted. And, you know, I'm 40 and black, spoiler alert, and black doesn't crack. I don't think that was the official hashtag, actually. Maybe it should have been. But once again, it was trying to use good brand identity without preaching at people and making people smile and, yeah, just having fun with it.
That makes sense. Did you have to do it all in Japanese?
I reckon by 3 a.m, it sounded like I was speaking in Japanese, but certainly not intentional.
Okay, excellent. Now, Nikki, because at DSM you're leading the partnerships team, it would be good to know from you, you're advising a lot of brands on sports rights, activating. Tell us a little bit about what you do and how you work with brands.
Yeah, I think for us, we're in such a busy and evolving sports industry. Generally, there is a lot of noise going on, all great, or not all great, but there is a lot of noise and distractions, certainly for Gen Z. There's new platforms, there's new opportunities. And I think what we try and do is really help brands cut through that noise, cut through the distractions to create those kind of meaningful partnerships that really see value. Nothing's really changed in that sports brand partnerships is still one of the leading marketing platforms that where a brand can really gain benefit, not just financially in terms of return on investment, although we do know that that is a successful platform for it, but also in talking to consumers, talking to a wider demographic range of fans. I think sport lends itself very nicely to that. It's got a universal language. It can reach, it can break down barriers, break down boundaries. But also what it does have is a consumer base that is passionate, emotive, and therefore allows brands to really create that deeper connection. And what we do at DSM is we sit in this kind of ecosystem between sport and gaming, entertainment and culture, which, as we know, those industries have never been more intertwined, but to support and help brands kind of merge together. And I think one of the greatest successes we've had recently was working with Xbox. You know, they are a gaming business, naturally, and so therefore not endemic into sport, but one thing they really believed in, what they wanted to do, was kind of create this joy of play. And so by combining that and layering that with our support, with bringing some lionesses into the game, we not only managed to open up a campaign whereby the lionesses could really share their story. And I think Gabby mentioned earlier about all these Lionesses have got their grassroots story, and people really resonate with that. And I think when you can layer a brand partnership with a personality, people trust personalities, people believe in personalities, that's where we start to see it come to life. They also brought this campaign where they brought in a grassroots girls team, and they were able to really leverage that opportunity in a storytelling way that meant it wasn't a hard sell. This wasn't an advert. This was more about, this is who we are, this is what we believe in, and this is how we can really create impact in the market. And that's what we see more and more, and that's where we try and help our clients, our partners, and just really bring together the right objectives of different brands and rights holders.
And you mentioned the Lionesses there, and Gabby, you were talking about this new influx of people who really got into women's sport, particularly around the Euros last year. How have you seen the storytelling evolve over time to not just get women's sport kind of in the headlines, but basically to keep that engagement with people long term?
I think personally, I was drawn to sport as a child because of the stories of people. I was never kind of somebody that wanted to sit and just study stats all day long, and that's part of my job now sometimes. But I like knowing people's journeys and how they got there, and you know, those kind of the struggles that they have, because that's very human, you know. And we look at these sports stars sometimes as being superhuman for what they achieve on a rugby pitch or a football pitch or an athletics arena, but actually, you know, they've all come from somewhere and have a story. And so I think the Lionesses are, most of them have experienced the struggle of kind of being given men's kit, only allowed to use pitches when the men have finished using the pitches. You know, you hear about kind of the lights going off and they're having to turn them back on at 9 o'clock at night, and you know, and yet they're going out on the pitch and competing as a Lioness in front of 90,000 people. But that's where their journey started, and they're really good at talking as well, because they've grown up with social media, so they're used to talking into phones, they're used to, you know, kind of posting things about themselves, and they're very open. They don't walk around like the men do, like this all the time. And hopefully won't. You know, if I could give the FA any advice heading to the Women's World Cup this year, it's, you know, don't let your women kind of develop those habits, because I think their openness is what I think is really attractive. And yep. And the inclusivity, you know, for some reason, there is still this massive difference between women's football and men's football in terms of being openly gay. And, you know, it's obviously the evolution of the women's sport has permitted them to be, you know, open about whatever they want to do and talk about. And I think that is really attractive. And and you don't have to kind of search for those stories and kind of manufacture them. They're there.
And do you think those are some of the things that will keep people engaged with the sport longer term rather than just kind of for the moment?
Yeah, it feels like people have been wanting this, you know, because I really feel build it and they will come, and they are coming. And, you know, the direct line between that women's final last summer and what happened on Sunday with that record-breaking crowd, I think, you know, it's 27,000 more than had ever come to an FA Cup final before. That's a massive growth in a year. Now, we're still not getting the same kind of viewing figures on TV as the men's game does, but that too will come, because the domestic game's getting stronger. You know, I think an English club breaking into the upper echelons in Europe and winning the Champions League again, it's been a long time for the women's game. All those things will continue to, you know, to have those stories told, you know, about those amazing women. And our league in the WSL has got a lot of foreign players as well, same as the men's. There's lots of, you know, great international stories there. So I think those stories really appeal to, if I'm a mum of young girls, I want them to see those women as their role models and their, you know, heroes. Not just those women, the England rugby team, who, you know, I alluded to that final game of the Six Nations, another record-breaking day at Twickenham. And you look at their captain, Marley Packer. She's gay, single, with a child, and was a former plumber, you know, and she's just there, you know.
She's got it all gathered.
Yeah, she's just out there, you know what I mean? She's just completely herself. She's her own, she's authentic, and she's not hiding anything. She's just brilliantly raw in terms of her, you know, her interviews, and approachable and appealing, and there are many more of them in that squad who are the same. And again, they've come through these really tough journeys to get to where they are now. So I think it really, you know, if you're not in women's sport right now, you know, you might have missed the boat, but get in as quickly as you can, because it's only getting better, I think.
And that's a really good point about the authenticity. And Hugo, obviously, we're hoping you're not one of the men. Now we know you do your content in Japanese. We know you're not one of the men, you know, making mistakes
rugby
in your
players
content.
Aren't quite doing it yet, are they?
They're not, and I desperately hope that they never get to that point. Sport looks at every sport, like rugby looks at football, and wonders how it can be that global superpower. But I know, speaking to people, they manage or own clubs, football looks at rugby and they want to understand how they can bottle that culture, because it's so appealing. I was on holiday just a few weeks ago and I was with this ex-professional footballer, and his son was playing football on the beach. Someone literally tapped him and he went down and was holding his ankle. And his dad was like, "What are you doing? Get up." But then his dad reflected, was like, "I did that for 15 years of my career." So the way in which the elite behave absolutely filters down to grassroots. And it's not just the players on the pitch, it's the people in the crowd, it's the referees that get impacted. And you've got a decision. Do you impact in a positive way or impact in a negative way? And I think, hey, whilst rugby's not perfect and every sport has its own troubles, I do think there's certain things in terms of fundamentals and the values that are just massively connected from grassroots to greats.
And in terms of the women's sport, because Gabby was talking about how to kind of keep people engaged with women's sport over time, you've been a big advocate for women's sport. What do you think the brands in this room could do to make a difference in this space?
Huge amount. I think, firstly, when we talk about athletes or players, you've got to delineate two things. We often spend a lot of time talking about talent, but the thing that drives the talent is the person, and the thing that actually connects people to people more so than anything is people. If I was to use Raheem Sterling as an example, I think he's absolutely fantastic at it. To think in a country, what, circa 65 million people, to think that you could be one of 11 to represent your country is quite difficult, unthinkable actually. But you hear his story, and we know millions of people like Raheem Sterling, know millions of people like Marley Packer. That's where you need to add your value. They're the stories that you need to tell. They're the things. People love people, right? Mm. So we need to tell more of those stories, because they're the things that we really relate to. So, I mean, for me, working across the men's and women's game in rugby, I much prefer going down to the Red Roses camp, spending time with them, way more personal. They're less media trained. They want to tell you who they are and what they are. And half of them used to have part-time jobs. They'd be like Marley, they'd be off plumbing in the day, training at night, teaching in the day, training at night, and then battering you on a Saturday, winning a Grand Slam, winning a World Cup, and then back in school on a Monday. Like, that's an amazing story. And that tells a story to me as a proud father of two girls, that look how human, they're like anyone and everyone that we see on the school run, but they have these incredible talents, but they are no different to the people that you surround yourselves by. So I'm so passionate about storytelling, because that really is the thing that engages people in. You know, we can talk about stats and facts and size of G-forces going through people's body, but it's not that interesting. I mean, I find it really interesting, but it's not that interesting to a large amount of people. And if you think about the Euros, which you covered so brilliantly, Gabby, telling those stories of who these people are makes you want to sit with them, makes you feel as if you know them, you can connect with them. And so that's exactly where I'd be putting my attention, for sure.
OK, so let's talk a little bit about brands and media. So one of your current clients, we mentioned Apple TV series Ted Lasso. It's pretty phenomenally popular. Yeah, everyone wants to know it. I've got a lot of questions. I won't ask you any of those ones. What I'm going to ask you is, tell us a little bit about some of the storytelling and marketing partnerships you've worked on around that brand.
Yeah, Ted Lasso is a really exciting project. It's phenomenal to be able to work with Warner Brothers on it from its inception. DSM kind of worked on it to the point where they even were involved in the consultancy around the name of naming the team AFC Richmond. And I think from where it started, which was, we consult them to create a very authentic football show. And from series one through now to we're just about to finish airing series three with Warner Brothers, where we get involved is we work with partnering with clubs, with talent, to be able to really bring this true storytelling to life through a show that is phenomenally popular. And I say that by, and what I mean by the storytelling piece is that, yes, it's a football show. Yes, it's a comedy. And I mentioned earlier, we sit in this ecosystem where we're intertwining industries, entertainment and sport. And you've got a comedy and a football show, but what they've also done is they start to use the show to tackle mental health issues. They showcase leadership, they showcase teamwork. And what that's been able to do is open up this wide reach of interest. You know, I've got friends and family who love watching it and they're not into sport at all. And so I think the ability, therefore, we then, as a consequence of working on Ted Lasso, is that we now do the marketing for Ted Lasso. It's in order to create these storytelling opportunities for them. And it's actually quite easy to do because actually you're working with an absolute pure partnership that makes sense, that talks to people, it resonates with people, it makes people listen, and you're talking on platforms that people are already in. They want to learn, they want to be part of this. And I think there is not one part of that show really that someone can't relate to in terms of the people, the storyline, and you know, so from a marketing point of view, from our side, you know, what we just try and do is to air those stories, make sure they are being told in the right places by the right people, and showcase the show as it really should be.
Can I just add to that, just because Netflix have done an unbelievable job, haven't they, storytelling. Drive to Survive is just brilliant. It's about F1, Formula One, but it's everything outside of it. It's become this reality show. Initially, they didn't get a massive buy-in, but then you see from season two, the likes of the Christian Horners desperate to find a camera. They understand the value, the sponsorship value, and I've forgotten the exact stats, but they saw their value in sponsorship rise exponentially. Now, Drive to Survive has been the second biggest reason for subscription on Netflix, which is huge. It's an absolute massive success. And whilst talking about football clubs, Ryan Reynolds, it's, you know, documented every single day his ownership of Wrexham. He wanted to get involved in Wrexham. He had a slight interest in football, but he was watching Sunderland Till I Die. I don't know if anyone's seen it. And for me, when you are telling stories, you've got your Last Dance, your Michael Jordan, exceptional greatness, and people love that. And then you've got your Sunderland Till I Die, absolute tragedy. No one wants anything in between, right? So you need to have a hook. And so whilst he was watching Sunderland Till I Die, he then did an experiment and went out and got some studies on different football clubs and landed with Wrexham. And ultimately, the reason he bought Wrexham was he wanted to create a documentary around it. That was it. He wanted to tell a story about this football club that has been undersubscribed, not loved, that once upon a time, back in the heydays, was this absolute epicentre of the community. And so he's bought a football club in order to be able to tell a story. Now he's deeply more engaged and they've just won promotion. That's fantastic. But isn't it amazing that the reason for someone wanting to spend millions of pounds is to have an asset to be able to tell a story about it?
I think that shows the value of that kind of media and content story. And Gabby, maybe you could tell me a bit more about The Midpoint, what you're doing with that.
So The Midpoint is a podcast which centres around being in the middle of life. And before you get cocky, 38 is what the Economic and Social...
I don't want to hear that.
Social Research Council say...
Remove that
fact. That's not for me, The Midpoint's not for me. In fact, I've started kind of squeezing slightly younger guests on because I think athletes have a midlife crisis younger than regular folk. So Jessica Ennis-Hill was very, very keen when she came on to declare she's definitely not in midlife. She's 37, but she would admit that at 30, her life was kind of a little bit kind of all up in the air. So it's about all the stuff that happens to us in the middle of life. You know, there's often that kind of squeeze period where your kids are kind of going in one direction in life and then parents become a little bit more needy in the other. Then you've got what goes on with women physically, with the menopause and the perimenopause, which is a conversation that's just grown massively in the last 4 to 5 years. And so I went to WYMNU with kind of this, we had a meeting and I had this idea that I wanted to do something, and busy, nothing happened, and then lockdown happened and I said, right, it's time to start this podcast. And from there, so many brilliant relationships with brands have grown. First of all, the model we had was we were sponsored by Solgar, and now we're on a different advertising model, and really interesting brands come and want to be part of it. And it's, for me, developed partnerships with Vitality and Menopace, and I feel, because I've been in sport for such a long time, a lot of the audience that I have kind of had on social media has been very male skewed. You know, taxi drivers know who I am, but when I go into Boots, maybe the woman, you know, behind the counter doesn't. And now the great joy for me is that women come and talk to me, And that's just, you know, kind of, it's really revelationary, because previously I felt like it was just, I was always talking to men, and that's partly because women's sport has changed, but also this, you know, midpoint kind of area, I think it's a conversation that obviously needed to be, you know, happening. So it's brilliant.
And I think that's really interesting, because do you think then it's opening up space for new brands, like you were mentioning, people who maybe wouldn't have participated in either sports or storytelling before as brands, are now being drawn in by those different stories?
Yeah, because I think it's, you know, the midlife audience has got money to spend, obviously. Yep. You know, that's one of the things we talk about, that it should be a period of your life where you should be getting to the stage where you're kind of feeling you're most confident, you're most comfortable financially. You should potentially be at that point where you're, you know, getting to a point where you've got some disposable income again, because your kids are getting, you know, older. And so, you know, from an advertiser's point of view, that's very, very attractive. And you kind of know a bit more about who you are as well, and you feel a bit more, but you're also perhaps wanting to just kind of shake things up a little bit and try new things. And that's what, for me, one of the motivations behind the podcast is to just not get stale and not, you know, I said, you know, kind of beige and middle-aged was one of the lines I used, that was the kind of previous preconception about being in that period of life. And it's absolutely not true. And people are doing really interesting things and changing their life. And you know, we're all going to be working a lot longer than our parents and our grandparents did. And so people in midlife thinking they want to make a change, why not? You've got 25 years potentially of a new career. So it's every day I kind of read something or see something that sparks an idea for another episode, so much so that we're on all the time now. So instead of being in a series, we're just dropping every week. And with Wyoming's help, you know, we've kind of improved all our assets. And it's been really a lovely thing to kind of start and watch grow and flourish and have kind of real investment in personally in terms of, you know, that area I'm really excited about, apart from the fact that one day I'll be too old to host the midpoint, and then I'm starting the end point, if anybody's interested in that. So
don't say that, Gabby. We're 22 approaching the early point. I think that's where we're going. Now look, we've only got about 5 minutes left, so what I wanted to ask each of you guys, we're thinking of the audience here of marketers, what advice would each of you give about working with both storytelling in the sports space that you think they should know? So Nikki, I'm going to start with you.
I think for me, the best advice would be is that we're not reinventing the wheel here. The message is still the same. It's just, let's tell the story in the way that the consumer really wants to hear it and also needs to hear it. Consumers are much more demanding. They know what they're after. They know what they'd like to hear. And so I think the main message from me is, you know, let's create the future generation of sports fans, of sporting athletes, but of general interest in the industry, be that gaming, esports, kind of in real life sports, but do it in a way that they want to hear it. And I think there's some really great opportunities. Uge mentioned earlier that people love people. And I think if you can layer any brand message through authentic people, that's the way to really achieve your objective.
Mine's simple, and there's been a couple of questions about rugby and broader audience. Well, the margin of growth in sports in general, women, absolutely women. When I look at, I think of the benefits of the investment into women's sport, A, because they deserve it, and by the way, it shouldn't be a grateful mentality that they have. They've earned the bloody right to get the things that have been way delayed and under-promised and under-delivered, and they're finally starting to get some of that. But also, for men's sport and men's rugby, if we have more women wanting to come to our game, it's a more buoyant, more illustrious sport that we have. So I think investment in the women's game, we've got a World Cup 2025 in England. We're hosting it. We're the number one side in the world. We've gone back to back to back to back Grand Slams. We've got record crowds at Twickenham. We've got the most phenomenal group of young women who appeal to such a broader range. When I think of the perception of rugby, and I think we need to be even more deliberate, men's rugby, it's middle class private school for white lads. Those things are not associated to the women's sport. It's way broader than that. So I think if you're spending your money and spending your time and attention, it would be in women's sport.
I think what's interesting as well, because of the women's sports, we've talked about being so open, their athletes being really open, really engaging. And I think the men's, you look at the Premier League, if you look at the Premier League as the kind of Rolls Royce or the, you know, the Ferrari, whatever, it's the upper kind of, you know, aspiration to have the billions of pounds it does in sponsorship and, you know, the global coverage. The men's game has realised that it has to be a bit more accessible, and that I've been doing coverage for Prime Video, yep. And we've been kind of on pitch with players and managers kind of joining us for the last couple of seasons. I've seen Sky doing that, I've seen BT doing that as well, because the players realise, I think, and the management realise that they have to be accessible, you know. So we've had matches where we haven't had, like, Ronaldo wasn't supposed to come in the studio at Man United earlier in the season, but because he saw Patrice Evra, he came over, and, you know, they weren't doing that 5 or 6 years ago. And I think that is a reflection of kind of how women's sport is influencing the men, because this is not going to cut it. You know, putting your hand above your mouth and, you know, constantly whispering to each other and not being accessible. You know, there were periods of my career, probably 10, 15 years ago, where you get monosyllabic one-word answers in sit-down interviews, if you were lucky. You had 6 minutes at the back of a broom cupboard. That sounds a bit rude, but you had 6 minutes to get something out of somebody.
Loads of time.
And now they realise they've got to give you time. They've got to give you a little bit of energy, because there's a competition out there, and at the moment, the women are smashing it.
Perfect. Well, look, we're just about out of time here. I got a little bit worried when you mentioned the broom cupboard. I think it's only Boris Becker who's been there in the sporting world. Definitely none of you guys. But I think we hit on some really important themes that are really important, particularly for the brands in this room and storytelling. And I think the big theme was just how open women's sport is, the opportunity to tell new and interesting stories in a different and much more inclusive way, I think, that we've ever seen before in the sporting world. That you can also be much more creative with those stories. We mentioned documentaries, different ways, social, even if you have to learn Japanese. You know, Hugo did it, you can too. And also looking for new areas. Gabby talked about the midpoint, new areas, new ways of bringing people into that sports conversation, brands who wouldn't have been there before, but new areas like women's sport and the menopause give us new opportunities. And I think there's just a real sense of the opportunity. You know, the only man on the panel here talked a lot about his vision of just how important women's sport is. And so I'm really excited to see what the future is going to look like.
Just say as well, and that was your up sum, so I'm sorry, but just the product, it's not just about the people.
Yeah.
The game itself, you know, is... So on Sunday when I was doing the Women's FA Cup final, I just... sent a picture of my, this sounds really dull, but I sent a picture of my lunch to my husband because it was a joke, because I'd over-ordered some food the day before, so I took it to work with me in a Tupperware box, which looks so glamorous. And I was just sending it to him as a joke. And he sent back a picture of himself watching the FA Cup with his kind of feet up, because he loves women's football, because he loves the authenticity, he loves the fact that women don't roll around, he loves the, well, on the pitch, he loves the fact that that women are, you know, true and honest. And that's not something that I've had to kind of, like, you know, you must watch, that is his own passion to watch that sport. And I think that's what we should also focus on, that the actual product is brilliant and entertaining.
What a perfect pace to stop. She can't stop talking about it because she loves it so much. And that is the power of a great story. Thank you so much, Gabby, Hugo and Nikki.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. For more podcasts like this one, be sure to check out Advertising Week's ever-growing network of audio content at www.advertisingweek.com/podcasts.